It's ESPN.
But our football today.
From Scout City, here's Jeremy Green.
Hello, and welcome to this episode of Football Today. I am not Jeremy Green, who remains on sick leave. I am your host slash producer, Jay Soderberg, joined by your host slash guest, Matt Williamson from Scouts, Inc. Matt, how are you?
Jay, I'm doing great, buddy. I got one little bone I need to pick with you, though.
Uh-oh. What's that?
Hey, I love the First Draft podcast. I listen to it every week.
Okay.
You can't let those guys push you around anymore, though. You got to lay down the law.
Well, you know, I'm really disappointed because this past week they talked about picks 22 to 32, and I missed it. And, of course, pick 22 is the Patriots. And I wanted to lambast them because they've got Brandon Graham there. I see no way the Patriots take Brandon Graham at pick number 22.
Oh, I think that's quite a possibility. I agree with them on that. But I can't say that you need to stand up. You need to let those guys know who's boss. You're the one pushing the buttons, brother.
No, I am the insignificant moderator on that particular program.
Not this show, though. I need you.
We're going to put Matt in the three-point stance. First up, we'll have ESPN.com NFL senior writer Len Pasquarelli, who was at the owners' meetings this week, so we'll be talking about that. We'll also be joined by NFL quarterback prospect Dan Lefevre from Central Michigan. He right now is currently a top five quarterback, according to most people, including the two gentlemen that host First Draft, Mel Kiper Jr. and Todd McShay. So we'll get his thoughts on preparing for the draft and all that good stuff. And then we'll finish out the show with some of Matt's thoughts on some of the other headlines, including some free agency signings. There's very few of them left that happened in the past week. So right now, let's just get right into it. Here's the three-point stance.
This is the three-point stance. Point one.
Len Pasquarelli joins us now. He really doesn't need an introduction at this point, but he is ESPN.com's NFL senior writer. Len, how's things going, man?
Good, Matt. How are you, sir?
I am great. Sitting here in my Pittsburgh home. Nice, clear day. Yeah, I'm pretty familiar with the town, I'm sure. You've spent some time here in your years.
My hometown. My folks are still there.
Yeah.
I have a brother that still lives there. And you're right in the heart of the action, my friend.
And that's what I need to bring up, man. This town is buzzing. What's going on with Ben Roethlisberger?
Well, so far nothing good. And although, as one of my colleagues continued to point out at the owners' meeting this week, he hasn't been charged with anything yet. And that's true. And I think the debate among the writers that I talked to was, even if he's not charged, Matt, is it under the purview of the commissioner and perhaps maybe even the Steelers to take some sort of action, you know, some sort of suspension to get his attention. And you know, my belief is that even if he isn't formally charged with a criminal act, that, yeah, it probably is within the player conduct guidelines for the commissioner and maybe even the Steelers to take some sort of action. Now, whether they will or not remains to be seen, you know, my feeling is that something will be done.
Really? Yeah. Is your hunch, if you were to lean one way or the other, would you think there's chances that something will be done by the league or the team? You know, the Steelers are considered a very high integrity football team, and ownership doesn't stand for that sort of thing. And
absolutely. And I can tell you, and I think I reported this in my tip sheet last week, that a week ago Wednesday, not this past Wednesday, but Wednesday a week ago, there was a really high-level meeting at the Steeler offices that included Dan Rooney, who was home from Ireland at the time, and you know, high-ranking team executives discussing what their options were in this matter. And as you point out, the Steelers have always been viewed as kind of a paragon in league circles. So maybe they make the first move. Maybe they make a preemptive strike, you know, that the league is in concert with. My feeling still is that you know, in my hunch, I shouldn't say my feeling, is that the league probably steps in here, but I wouldn't be surprised if the Steelers do something first.
Do you think that in turn leads to the signing of a Dante Culpepper, or a Byron Leftwich, or maybe they draft a quarterback in the mid rounds, or do you think they just live with Dennis Dixon and like what they've seen?
I think the latter of those two, man. I mean, I heard very little at the owners' meetings to persuade me that the Steelers were shopping around for a veteran quarterback or that they would draft one. And that, you know, they're pretty pleased with the progress that Dennis Dixon has made. And if it's one game or so, and you know, my hunch is that it wouldn't be, you know, a prolonged work stoppage for Ben Roethlisberger, a prolonged suspension, that they just go with what they've got for a game or so.
And that makes sense to me. I think Dixon has showed promise as well, and he could really develop into a fine backup, if not better.
And this is a team that even though their history in the last couple weeks precludes this with bringing back, you know, Randall Allen and Larry Foote, you know, doesn't reach all that hard for veteran guys. They tend to develop guys, as you well know, from within and kind of count on their own, and Kevin Colbert and their scouts to bring in the right people and develop them. And I would be really surprised if they reach for a veteran quarterback or even one in the draft.
That makes sense. You know, you had touched about the owners' meetings, and it seemed like the talk of the owners' meetings, maybe the biggest story that came out of that was the overtime proposal passes. And I'm curious how that went down. It sounded like there was some
shenanigans, perhaps?
Perhaps, yeah. I know how exactly to put that. I'm new to the interview world here, but the you know, coaches and owners didn't quite see eye to eye on it. And can you kind of fill everybody in on what you know about that whole situation?
Well, you know, think of President Obama and health care. I mean, and the procedural gymnastics that they had to go through. And you know, I'm certainly not showing politics here, but it's no secret that there were some, you know, there were some procedural things that the Congress had to do to get the health care passed. Same way with the overtime. I mean, they purposely, it seemed like, waited until Tuesday until most, if not all, the coaches were on the golf course. I think Sean Payton found out about it, Matt, via a text message he got at Arnold Palmer's tournament. And he was very outspoken. But you know, we did a survey, I think, of 18 coaches, and 11 were either against it or leaning against it. But the feeling of the owners was it was time to do it. They were scared by the NFC game, Minnesota and New Orleans going into overtime, and just as scared by the potential that Peyton Manning was going to take the Colts down the field and tie the game up in the Super Bowl and force an overtime. And so the owners just felt like, hey, we're paying these coaches a lot of money. They have some say-so with us, but, you know, we'll live with it. Slam the thing through. I think there was plenty of arm-twisting by Commissioner Goodell, who, you know, let's face it, I admire Roger and what he's done so far, but, you know, he put one over on the coaches on this one, no doubt about it.
What I don't quite get, and I haven't done a whole lot of research on it, is why the coaches have a problem with it. I'm not sure why that undermines them or why they don't like the new rule.
You know, Matt, I think that Mike Shanahan pretty well. Coaches are not in favor of change in general.
Ever.
And I think his quote was, if it was up to the coaches, we'd still be watching 16-millimeter tape of prospects. And it adds another layer of responsibility and decision-making for the coaches. And they don't particularly like that. They feel like, you know, their job by definition is one that puts them on thin ice from the minute they take the job, and that they would just as soon have fewer decisions to make in a game. And this adds another layer of responsibility. And plus, I think that some coaches feel like if you're going to put this rule in, put it in for good. Put it in for all games, not just playoff games. You know, let's not make playoff games, even though they are more important than other games, not more important than the regular season games, and either do it for every game or don't do it at all.
I guess there's some logic to that. To me, I don't understand why you would have two different sets of rules just because you go to the postseason. And being around coaches, it is very true. They like a very static environment. They don't like to have to think about one extra thing. And I think that's a really good point by you.
Well, the rationale of Rich McKay, the chairman of the competition committee, is that they already have different rules, you know, for the playoffs. And those rules are, hey, if you lose in the playoffs, you're done. It's one and done. Whereas in the season, if you lose, you generally have another week or two to make up for that loss. And and compensate for that loss. And that the other change is that, you know, in the playoffs, the overtime is until somebody wins. It's not 15 timed minutes, and if there's a tie at the end of those 15 minutes, you know, the game goes into the books as a tie. Rather flimsy rationale, I think, on the part of Rich McKay and the competition committee, but hey, a rationale nonetheless.
Yeah, that's well said, too. This whole overtime thing, to me, isn't that big a deal, but I haven't heard anything that I say, I jump up and down and say, boy, that's the answer. You know, there's been a lot of different propositions over the years. You know, the college way, I don't think that's the way to go at all, but overall, I just look at it like, I don't like any of these ideas. There is no perfect answer.
Yeah, I'm not a big fan of change either, Matt, but and I haven't had time to research this, but as a fellow scribe pointed out to me, how many games does it really affect? I think he pointed out that it affects, you know, in the last, you know, 14 or 15 years, it might have affected like four games total.
Wow.
And, you know, that's not a lot. In the big picture, you know, it's not going to really have ramifications in a lot of games. But the point is, it is the big picture. It's the playoffs. Owners and the competition committee see it as such, and that raises it, in their minds at least, to another level.
And right now, you know, let's get back to football a little bit. This is the point where it's draft prep time. You know, free agency's more or less come and gone. There's not a lot of action in that regard. And all the front offices are buckling down. They're starting to really put a lot of attention into building their board, you know, watching that final tape, getting their final grades in. So there's one more big story, it seems like, in the world of personnel, and that's obviously the Eagles quarterback situation.
Sure.
And what are you hearing? What's your hunch? Is somebody going to move? You know, now the Eagles have come out and said they want a top 42 pick for McNabb, which I think is sort of curious because it does include Buffalo, the Raiders, and the Rams all in the second round, which I think have to be the three teams that are most involved.
You know, I will tell you that the quarterbacks most mentioned in Orlando earlier this week in some order were Ben Roethlisberger, Tim Tebow, and Donovan McNabb, maybe in that order, quite frankly. I've long been on record as saying I don't think McNabb will be traded. Now maybe I've been swayed from that opinion, Matt, in the last week or two. I don't know. I've certainly not been able to independently verify that the Eagles are looking for a pick in the top 42. I'm told by Eagles people I trust that while they are, quote-unquote, entertaining offers, they're not necessarily shopping McNabb actively and that he probably won't be traded. And I'll live with that for now, Matt. But you know, where there's smoke, there's fire. And there's plenty of smoke floating around right now. Now, you know, if they've got to give up a cornerback or a veteran starter type player in addition to Donovan McNabb, even to bring in a Nnamdi Asamoah, which is the name rumored to be kicked around, you know, that's a lot. I mean, Donovan McNabb is not, you know, and you know this, Matt, in terms of quarterbacks, you know, an ancient guy. He's what, 33 years old or something like that. You know, that's. You know, that's not rocking chair age for a quarterback, although it is somewhat old, not necessarily for that position. So, you know, I think the price tag right now is a bit high in terms of what the Eagles might have to give up in addition to McNabb. So we'll see. But for now, at least, and I, you know, I emphasize for now, Matt, you know, I'll stick to the belief that Donovan McNabb is going to be with the Eagles come the start of the season.
Is it safe to say from your sources and people you've talked to that the market for Vic isn't particularly high and the Eagles' thoughts on Kevin Cobb are very high, you know, that they love?
Yeah, I think your assessment, Matt, is right on. They've not gotten much if any action on Vic. I know there's a team or two that's, you know, kind of tempted by that, but yeah, I mean, they're holding them, hoping that they the stakes, you know, are raised, but they've not been so far. And they like Cobb, as you said, an awful lot. So, you know, if somebody were to go, maybe it's McNabb, but boy, talking to Andy Reid at the owners' meetings and talking to Joe Banner, their team president, it's going to take an awful lot to get McNabb away from them.
One last question along these lines is, how do you think Reid, Banner, the Eagles in general, look at their football team? You know, are they a contender? Is it a live for today situation? Or, hey, Dallas just rolled us twice. And you look at the offense, it's Macklin, DeSean Jackson, McCoy, Celek. They're very, very young on offense. Is this their version of a rebuilding time, you know, where we go with Cobb and we say maybe a year from now we're a contender?
I don't know, Matt.
Win now.
Yeah, I don't know if it's rebuilding, but it's kind of what, you know, owner Jeff Lurie and Joe Banner have promised to people. We will be competitive every year. There will be no major downturn. So I think, you know, with Westbrook gone and the change in receivers and adding more speed and things like that, yeah, I mean, we would all be naive to think that they're not in some, you know, some degree of transition, because they are. They're not the same team, Matt, as you know, a team that where everything went through Westbrook a year or two ago. They're not like that anymore. And you know, I think defensively they know that they need, oh, you know, some more pieces. I mean, the death of Jim Johnson has affected that team. They're clearly trying to come up with another pass rush guy. But, I don't think that they see themselves as a team that, you know, has to regroup significantly to be a playoff team. They're right at the fringe of the playoffs, you know, as they were last year. Are they a Super Bowl contender? There are probably a lot of teams in this league, Matt, right now, who wouldn't mind being in the shape that the Philadelphia Eagles are. And in another year or two, maybe they contend for a Super Bowl. But, you know, whether getting rid of McNabb is part of that process and turning the team over to Kevin Cobb, you know, that remains to be seen.
Just from a football standpoint and being a personnel evaluator, this team is just so strong year after year. They're right there with the Colts and the Steelers and the Patriots that they never really have those downtimes.
Yeah.
And I think people need to be careful what they wish for, and I would bet on the Eagles to make the right decision here.
No, I think you're right. I mean, they're real strong at the top. I mean, Joe Banner is not only one of the best, you know, he doesn't have a great football background before he came to the Eagles, but he's a good evaluator. He's a terrific cap guy. You know, we saw a week or two ago where they had that cut loose Sean Andrews, but boy, very few of the deals they've done, and they, you know, their MO is that they do deal. They identify guys early that they want to keep, and they sign them to these extensions, you know, only a year or two into their careers. Very few of those deals have blown up in their face. Now, you know, the Andrews one absolutely did. They spent a lot of money on Andrews, and injuries kind of scuttled his career. But they're a well-run organization like the team in the city where you live, and I wouldn't bet against them either.
Glenn, thanks so much. Very insightful as always.
All right, Matt, take care. Have a good day.
You too. We are now fortunate enough to have Dan LeFever with us, a prospect for this upcoming draft, quarterback out of Central Michigan. Dan, hey, it's great to have you on the show, buddy. I'm glad you made it.
Thanks for having me.
Oh, absolutely. Hey, I'm curious. I know your pro day was very recently, right? It was this week, correct?
Yes, it was.
How did that go for you?
It went well, you know, showed some things that I was capable of doing, but, you know, as a competitor, you're never really satisfied with how you did. You're never going to reach perfection, but I feel like I put a lot of great things out there, and, you know, we're definitely taking steps forward.
Good, good. I don't know that the general public knows what goes on for a quarterback's pro day. Can you kind of spell it out a little bit, give a little bit of the details? Did you guys script it, or what exactly did you guys do?
Yes, I worked with Coach Zeke Bradkowski, who played in the NFL for 14 years, coached for 26 years. He scripted the pro day. You have the ability to redo anything you did at the combine as far as 40, shuttle, L drill, bench, all those types of things. I just chose to throw, and we got to be able to put the script together of about 60 throws, and you're able to do those consecutively as opposed to the combine where you make about 12 throws and that's about it.
And you know what's coming. I mean, you know what the next throw is going to be. You know what's pretty much on the slate. It's pretty much a scripted situation, right?
Exactly. It's something I was working on for a few weeks and very familiar with, so no surprises from that standpoint.
Cool. My question to you was, I had read that you only threw to stationary targets at your pro day. Is that true?
Yes, it is.
Is there a reason behind that? Do you think that's a benefit to you? Or I'm just curious what the logic is to doing that as opposed to throwing to live route runners.
Well, you know, I didn't throw about 12 routes at the combine. That's it. You know, I didn't realize what a big deal that was. when I decided to make that decision. I guess, you know, my thought process was coming from the shotgun to under center, being able to work with guys that I'm familiar with on campus, guys that I've thrown to for 4 or 5 years. You know, being able to throw 60 throws and get into a rhythm a little bit and being able to control what routes I'm throwing too. So, you know, having that script and being able to work on that a little bit more gives me the ability to put the best product out there.
That makes sense. And I'm sure everybody realizes what you're doing is marketing yourself the absolute best you can. I mean, it's a very long job interview process, and I'm sure you realize that as well.
That's exactly right. You know, you got to do whatever's best for you in this situation, and just try to do what will showcase what you can do the best.
Okay. And you touched on it a little bit, and I'm not sure the audience knows. I mean, you didn't come from a huge school. It wasn't like you were on TV nationally like Notre Dame every week. What is the difference between the offense you ran in college and what adjustments do you really have to make going forward to a typical NFL-style offense?
Well, the biggest thing that I've had to do is just work on going under center. You know, you talk about pass concepts and things like that. Football's football. It's not going to change too much. It's coined the spread offense and stuff like that. But, you know, there's certain combinations in the pass game that, you know, are pretty universal and go across the board. Pretty much for me, it was just all the techniques going under center, from a drop back to transferring your weight to rhythm and timing. All those things that you just need to adjust a little bit, I've been working on.
Okay. And what you did was almost every one of your snaps in college was from the shotgun?
Yeah, everything except taking a knee and quarterback sneaks.
Okay. Okay. So one other aspect of that I don't think it's talked about a lot is your actual vision. I mean, is that something that's been difficult for you, or is a transition period of where your eyes are as you're stepping back and dropping into the pocket?
You know what? It hasn't been that difficult too far. It definitely is different. You know, your vantage point's different from under center to being in the shotgun. At the same time, your eyes can be up the whole time. You're not trying to catch a pass and try to read a defense at the same time. So there's advantages and disadvantages to going under center. And the more that I'm doing it, the more I'm becoming comfortable with it.
Good, good. What do you think is your greatest asset to a team, on and off the field?
I'd say accuracy, arm strength, being able to make plays on the run, and just being a great leader, too. I think those are things that you need to bring to the table when you're a quarterback, and those are things that I feel I do really well.
Good. Is there anyone you've, like, patterned your game off after? You know, you watch a lot of the NFL. Do you think, boy, I see some of myself in that quarterback, or, boy, I'd really like to play like him, or anything along those lines? Or I'm not saying you're not your own man, but is there things you've taken from specific quarterbacks that you've watched that have come ahead of you?
Sure. You know, it kills me to say it, but growing up in Chicago and admiring Brett Favre with the Packers, obviously,
sure,
watching him for a long time, I admire his toughness. I like the way Tony Romo is able to move around in the pocket and make plays. I like his quick release. You know, there's a lot of things that different quarterbacks bring to the table, but there's not really one specific guy that I've tried to pattern myself after.
Now, I'm guessing that it's not an accident that you picked two pretty mobile quarterbacks over their careers, too. And I don't know that everyone out there realizes it, but that's one of your greatest strengths, is you make an awful lot of plays with your feet.
Sure. You know, and it's fun to watch guys do that at the next level and think, oh, man, you know, I think I can do that, too. So that gives me a lot of hope.
Good. And the other thing is, Tim Tebow's getting pressed like crazy. Do you see yourself as a similar player to him? He's the one that everybody's seen on the field. He went to Florida, you went to Central Michigan, so there is some differences as your exposure. But from where I sit, I see a lot of similarities in your guys' game. Very, very productive, make a ton of plays with their feet, good leadership. Do you see any correlation between the two of you?
Well, you know, anytime you compare two guys that run the quote-unquote spread offense, there's going to be comparisons right or wrong. Now, I will say, just watching a little bit of Florida this year, you know, it's tough, obviously, with us playing on Saturdays as well, but they do something similar, but they're their own identity as well as an offense. So it's tough to compare two guys that are in completely different situations, in my opinion.
Yeah, that's very valid, I think, too. And you play in the MAC, and once again, I'm not downplaying the MAC. I spent some time at Akron. I was their director of football operations. I'm from the Pittsburgh area. I've watched a lot of MAC football, and I think it's a lot better than what people realize. Is there a defensive player that you played against in your conference that really stood out to you over your career and say, wow, this guy's really something?
Yeah, I have to go with Larry English, who's now with the San Diego Chargers.
Sure, first-round pick last year.
Yeah, he definitely gave me a lot of grief playing against him for a few years coming off the edge.
Some he put you on the ground a few times?
Not that I like to admit, but yeah.
The film doesn't lie, though. It's still there.
It doesn't. But, you know, he was obviously a great player and someone we had to game plan around. You know, I'm glad when he graduated that he did and he was out of there. But, you know, he was a guy that was really just a great football player and someone fun to watch as well.
Anybody else come to mind that's in his class?
You know what? I mean, he's the one, when people ask me that question, he's the guy that pops up right away. We've played, you know, other guys from different teams, not in the MAC, but he's the one that really pops up.
Yeah, it's hard to argue
with. I'd say Michael Mitchell as well, from Ohio, who got drafted by the Raiders in the second round. Yes.
And, okay, you went to a smaller school, like we touched on a little bit, Central Michigan. Were you recruited by a lot of D1 schools? How's that now contrast to being such a high-profile guy? You know, most boards you're considered a top-five quarterback, and you got a chance to get drafted rather high this upcoming draft. Is it a different perspective of moving on to the next level as it was coming out of high school?
Well, sure. You know, in high school we ran the double wing, threw the ball maybe 10 times a game. Only had about 3 to 4 scholarship offers coming out. 3 of them were MAC, and one was a double A. So it has changed quite a bit for me, but, you know, every time you reach a certain point in your career, you kind of reset your expectations and your goals. So it is different, but it's something that I would expect at this level, and I think anyone in the draft would expect to get the type of national attention and trying to get to the next level just like me.
Yeah, that makes sense, too. Dan, I did a lot of recruiting in my day, and I know it's something that happens a lot, is that when you come from an offense like you did in high school and you are as big and strong and athletic as you are, and I'm sure you were at that point, were people asking you to switch positions? Were there some colleges out there saying, yeah, I would like to make you a linebacker, a tight end, whatever?
Actually, that never came up. Just running this, playing quarterback in high school and, you know, being able to have some success early in college, I was never asked through the recruiting process or when I got to Central Michigan to consider that.
Good, and you've been obviously very successful and made the right decision. Give me a little insight on the Senior Bowl. You know, I'm not sure, once again, that our listening audience knows what goes on there. I mean, you can watch the practices on the NFL Network and all that, and you can probably get somewhat of a feel for it when you're sitting in your living room, but there's an awful lot that goes on behind the scenes, too. I mean, those evenings between practices, all those type of things. Can you kind of give us a day in the life of the Senior Bowl?
Yeah. I mean, first day I arrived there, right away, you got to go pick up all your equipment and get fitted for, you know, girdles and pants and jerseys, all those things. And you get all this gear, and you got to go back to your room, take it back, hurry up down to eat dinner, and have a team meeting, and then you're released to have another team meeting about the playbook and everything and that you're going to install for, you know, 1 week, and you got to be able to effectively run it. And then you're in this room where every team is there, and you can talk to everybody, and you're just knocking out interviews with different guys for about 2 to 3 hours. And the next morning you get up for practice, more team meetings, and then same thing all over again, talking to teams, walking through the lobby and grabbing guys and talking to different coaches and things like that. So it's just really like a whirlwind. And as the week tapers down, people start to leave and go home, and even teams, NFL teams, go home to watch the game on their own TV at home. So it starts to wind down a little bit, but at first it's a little bit of controlled chaos.
Yeah, I mean, I've been there, and I understand that it's hard for you to walk anywhere without some scout of some level grabbing you and saying, hey, Dan, let me get a couple minutes of your time. And of course, being the good citizen and trying to put on the good face, you always have to say yes. And meanwhile, you're saying, I'm a quarterback trying to learn a new offense and lead my team, and I only have a few practices to show that off at the Senior Bowl. It's a pretty demanding situation.
It definitely is, and you got to have the right expectations going into something like that. Obviously, you're going there to play a game and you're going to win, but, you know, you're trying to showcase what you have, being able to play for the next level. So, you know, you really got to take those in advantage of those interviews.
You know, we touched on your pro day, and I'm curious what you thought of your performance at the Senior Bowl, in the game and during practice as a whole.
It went well. You know, and coming from the shotgun, going under center was a little difficult, like I was talking about, just the techniques you got to get used to. But overall, I think that was a positive and, you know, help my stock as a potential person in the draft. But, you know, obviously just being a competitor too, you want to be perfect. And, you know, there are a few throws that got away from me that I'm still a little bit angry about. But overall, it was a positive.
Good deal. Good deal. Hey, Dan, I wish you all the best of luck, and I hope you get drafted and higher than you expect. It's been a great pleasure talking to you, bud.
All right, thank you very much.
Anytime.
All right, Matt, let's do some quick slants here now. We had two great guests. Now I'm going to put you under the microscope here. And we're kind of, these are in chronological order. I know people are going to accuse me of being a homer, but our first note here is that the Patriots agree with tight end LG Crumpler. They needed a body. That's how I look at this.
Yeah, I look at it that way too, but I'm looking into it even a little more. Is, remember we were talking, I think it was the last podcast we did, either the last one or the week before, as what are they doing at tight end? They got nothing. And I mentioned they went to a lot of six offensive line sets last year because Belichick's really good at using his personnel. You know, Vollmer was a guy that needed to get on the field. But Crumpler, to me, is as much offensive tackle as he is tight end anymore. Have you seen him lately?
Yeah, he's big.
He's a large mammal, and he's a blocker now and a very good one. And can he catch the ball still? Yes, but he's not the Algy Crumpler from his Atlanta Falcons days. So I think this might be a further indication that the tight end is going to be a spot player slash blocker more than anything.
And they do have those three second-round picks still.
And it's a nice spot to go get a Pita or a McCoy or a guy like that, too. And this draft does set up pretty well for a pass-catching second-round tight end.
Quick slants.
From the Cardinals, they signed linebacker Joey Porter to a three-year deal worth $17.5 million. That's according to ESPN's Adam Schefter.
Good leadership guy who is very respected and liked by his teammates. Obviously, there's a connection here with all of them being together with the Steelers, Wisenhunt, Grimm. Porter was in his prime back then. I don't think he's nearly the player now that he used to be. You know, so he teams with Clark Hagans again to be the Steeler outside linebacker core. I could take or leave the move. I understand it because they've been hit pretty hard by free agency. They need to do something. They have the kid Brown, who they took in the second round last year, who they're going to try to develop as an outside linebacker. They got nothing from last year due to injury, and that's going to take some time. But they're really old at this position now, with the exception of Brown. And I guess it's a bit of a desperate move because they need help badly at outside linebacker to me. There's no difference maker. I don't think Porter's that guy, but he's yet another body who's able.
Quick slants.
The compensatory draft picks were awarded. The Bengals, Titans, and Falcons all got third-rounders. The Patriots ended up getting the most of four picks. Panthers, Steelers, Titans got three. Since 1994, the teams that have had the most compensatory picks awarded to them are the Ravens with 29, the Cowboys had 28, Eagles 27, Patriots and Rams 26, Titans and Packers had 25 since 1994.
Yeah, it's obviously a nice thing to get, obviously. Any kind you can get an asset like that and add players in any regard, it's a wonderful thing. But I'm not sure the general public realizes either, you can't trade those picks. So you can make other moves with your existing picks. You can package them up. But some of these teams, like I was asked locally here in Pittsburgh, the Steelers have 10 picks. But do they really have 10 spots on their roster where guys can come in and help them? Probably not. So you mentioned a couple teams that did well. I could see them being now trade-up candidates. Say, hey, I'll give you my fourth and third to get into the end of the second round or something along those lines. So it's a good thing to have, but I kind of wish you could trade them. I'm not sure what the logic is of not being able to move those picks.
Yeah, I don't know. The Patriots ended up with, of their four, three of them are seventh-rounders. Now, what I've read from from Mike Reese, who writes for ESPNBoston.com, he mentioned how this sort of gives them an opportunity to sign some guys who they might be looking at as free agents but don't have to compete with other teams to get them to come to New England.
Which is basically what the end of the seventh round is. But, you know, once again, it's a pretty strong team. How many picks can you get that'll actually make your roster? So that makes you think that, you know, in fifth, sixth, seventh round, they might package, you know, their existing picks to move up or grab some assets that they're so good at doing for the upcoming draft a year from now.
I was going to say,
that's their move.
They always trade picks for next year.
Yeah.
Quick slants.
Josh McDaniel says Kyle Orton is the starting quarterback. Brady Quinn is the backup. That's something you said a couple weeks ago here on this podcast.
Yeah, that's no shock to me. I don't love Kyle Orton, don't get me wrong, but he's a lot better football player than Brady Quinn is right now. I've seen very little from Quinn to say, yeah, he deserves to be a starting quarterback right now. He should be a backup. He should be happy about that. I think he could do him a lot of good with no pressure on his shoulders, learn, sit back, you know, listen to Josh McDaniels, and go from there. I like the pickup for Denver, but I don't expect him to come in and make immediate contributions.
Quick slants.
ESPN.com AFC East blogger Tim Graham says free agent quarterback Dante Culpepper is targeting the Bills, which would make sense since they need a quarterback, but does it make sense for the Bills?
Yeah, you can target teams all you want, but I don't know why they would bring in Culpepper. He's looked terrible the last couple of years, getting up in age. You know, ever since that knee injury, he hasn't been close to what he was with the Vikes. They already have two mediocre at best quarterbacks. Why bring in a third?
Quick slants.
Jim Schwartz says the Lions are definitely interested in Adam Jones. That would be the man formerly known as Pac-Man.
Corner is a massive need for that football team. Jones is very talented. Schwartz knows him, and so there is a relationship there from their Titan days. This adds up to me. I don't have a problem with it, and I would imagine that much like the Matt Jones signing, the Dante Stallworth signing, they're not going to invest a ton in this young man who's got off-the-field troubles. Let's just leave it at that. And if it doesn't work out, if he rubs people wrong, bye. You know, so be it.
Quick slants.
The Newark Star-Ledger reporting that Giants defensive end O.C. Umunyura battling complications from a lingering hip injury. He also apparently was asked repeatedly about what his role with the Giants defense will be, and he declined comment 8 times in a recent interview.
Things haven't gone well for O.C. over the last year or so, and he was a player. It makes you wonder, if this hip is going to be chronic, like you said. He was never a real stout run stuffer. He's not a big, heavy defensive end. He was built for speed, long, lean, edge guy, and he didn't bring a lot of that to the table. You know, the former defensive coordinator took some of the heat for that and probably deservedly so. But I think O.C. might need to look in the mirror and say, I might be in a little bit of trouble here, because if I can't rely on my speed, quickness due to injuries, this hip problem, he's going to be inconsequential sooner than later.
Quick slants.
Rex Ryan says he's disappointed by Leon Washington's absence. Washington, recovering from a broken right leg, was rehabilitating at the team's facility until he was offered a second-round restricted free agent tender earlier this month. The former Pro Bowl kick returner is now working out on his own, something that irks Ryan. The coach said Thursday that although the team workouts are voluntary, he believes Washington should be with his teammates because of the Jets' outstanding facilities. Let's revisit that Pod Vader plan, shall we? This sounds more and more like Leon Washington could be on the outs with the New York Jets.
Maybe. And I could see him being very attractive to several teams out there for a second-round pick. The Niners come to mind. You obviously mentioned the Patriots. I think he's a dynamic change of pace, take-it-to-the-house guy who's also an excellent receiver, an excellent returner. But it comes back to that rehab. You can't give up a second-round pick or, you know, offer him something right now not knowing how recovered he is. And he's another one. He's built on speed. He's built on quickness. You know, if one of those legs isn't working all that well, you can't give up such a strong asset as a second-round pick. And, of course, Rex Ryan wants him there, and I understand that, too. He's a very outspoken coach, says what he believes, and why wouldn't you want your guy there?
By the way, in response to Jets fans that sent us emails to footballtoday@espnradio.com about our apparent lack of knowledge of the Jets-Giants stadium there in the Meadowlands, people, the Giants were in the Meadowlands first. That's all I was saying. Get over it. And I said, go get your own stadium. And they were like, well, the Jets tried to build their own stadium, but they couldn't do it, and so it worked out financially. Well, that's my point. If you couldn't build your own stadium, you're still sharing a stadium. It has nothing to do with the fact that the Jets are in the same division as the Patriots. I would say this about any team that shares a stadium. That was my whole point.
Well, to quote Pod Vader, I'm going to give you one of these.
Quick slants.
It's probably best to stay off the emailer's bad side. Jerry Jones says the Cowboys have thought about starting Felix Jones over Marion Barber. That's according to DallasCowboys.com.
Well, they're all going to play. I mean, Choice might be even better player than Barber right now. Barber's a good football player. I think he's a declining player, though. He is such a rugged runner that, like a Brandon Jacobs, I don't see those guys having a long shelf life. So he'd be nice to kind of ease him along, not rely on Barber throughout the whole season so that you have him rather fresh as you get down the stretch. But Felix Jones, to me, is a much better football player than Barber right now. They're obviously very different. Depends what you want to do. You know, you look at the Cowboys' offensive line. They're big, big boys. You know, they want to be physical with the running back position. But Jones is a pretty special talent, and he's so much more dynamic. I think he deserves more touches than Barber, and I'm not so sure that Choice doesn't, too.
See, now that's interesting. If you're a team needing a running back, let's say you're the
Chargers.
Sure, why not? What are you giving up to get Marion Barber on your team?
Not much, because he's damaged goods, and I think there's a lot of tread off his tires. I'm calling to say, hey, I'll give you a third round pick for Tashard Choice, and if I'm Dallas, I'm saying no.
Well, obviously,
right. So I mean, it's kind of, in a lesser degree, it's sort of like the McNabb situation where you know. Felix Jones isn't going anywhere. He'd cost you way too much. He's the future. He's your Kevin Cobb type. Barber's kind of the been there, done that, semi-washed up guy, like a McNabb, that isn't the one that isn't the apple of everyone's eye anymore. And it's considering his position, much unlike McNabb, who knows how much longer you're going to have him around. So I don't want a guy with the arrow going down at a position that takes that much of a beating when I can just draft somebody.
I mean, this is where I think the salary cap, not having a salary cap, comes into play. Because clearly the Cowboys can keep all three of these guys without any sort of issue. Whereas right. If there was a salary cap, this might be a situation where if somebody came calling for Marion Barber and offered you a third, you would take it.
Oh, yeah. I wouldn't doubt that they take a third now for Barber. I don't think they'd take it for Choice. But if there was a cap, you could see a situation where you actually cut Barber. He's expensive.
Now that deserves a big time.
Just a bad idea.
It's going to be the new catchphrase here. Thanks for downloading this issue of Football Today on ESPNRadio.com's Pod Center. I don't know why I went in that direction, but I did. You've been listening to Matt Williamson. I want to say thanks to Len Pasquarelli and Dan LeFevre, who are both our guests here on today's show. Keep sending us emails to footballtoday@espnradio.com. We didn't have time today, but we might have some time next week to get to some more emails. I know we've got a bunch of guests coming up in the next couple weeks, so you're going to want to stay tuned for that. Thank you, Matt, for joining us again today.
Thank you, buddy.
And there you have it.
There you have it.
The music provided on today's show is from Mevio's Music Alley, Will Chryski's Metal Mayhem. Check it out at music.mevio.com. For more football talk, be sure to check out Football Tonight, Monday through Thursday at 10 p.m. Eastern on ESPN Radio and ESPNRadio.com.